Cameron's journey, like the real kind of nexus of faith journey, seems to play out somewhere across the years 16 to 26. That seems to be where big decisions are being made. I bought a bunch of books. These are kind of my favourite current reads at the moment, which you're welcome to look at. Sharon Parks wrote a book which she called Big Questions, Worthy Dreams, and I think that in a part that kind of nails it, that it seems to be the period of really big questions and really big dreams, and sometimes it's actually hard to hold the two together. The where I've come from with my big questions and where I'm going to with my worthy dreams, and somehow I'm not sure if I can quite fit it all together. And Sharon worked in the States with college-age young people quite significantly for a long time, and really sort of started to steer into that space. So here's the plan for this morning. We've got a little bit of time, which is good. I'm not very good with linear presentations, so I'm going to do my best with what we've got to look at. I've put together just a whole bunch of stuff that, depending on where we go and what you're interested in and how you sort of feedback to me and so forth, we can explore. I've got some mixture of some video that's come out of the States of interviews with some young adults in terms of how they're travelling in their faith, and also some written pieces that we've had from students over the years where we've asked them, what are you grappling with at the moment? Like, what is getting between you and just firing on for Jesus kind of thing? And so just, yeah, it might feel like a bit of a downer, but for me it's kind of like as soon as you kind of really get to know someone, particularly in this space, there's a lot of good news and there's a lot of questions that are there that I think need to be honest. So we're just going to start with, so just steer into that space to see what people are asking and what kinds of things are big in the minds of people. What I particularly want to do is to look at what is the last 5 years of research. And I really love this kind of mixed group where we've got people who are young adults, who are emerging and young adults. And so what I'm going to be introducing to you is not necessarily my opinion, but what a bunch of dudes who've been doing a whole bunch of research think is going on with you. And that doesn't put the power with them, that puts the power back to you, where you can say, well, I'm seeing that, I'm not seeing that, that is my experience, that's not my experience. But as I've been reading it, it's been helping me at least to find a little bit of a language to describe a little bit of what's going on. And there's a few numbers and statistics of some pretty large-scale pieces of research that are going on out there. So I'm interested to hear what you think about that, what's going on. Some of it's Aussie, some of it's American, some of it's UK. So we'll look around that, and it sort of looks about the incidence of faith, and then the next thing that we'll look at, if we run out of time, then we won't look at it. But there's some very important work that's come out from a guy called Chapman Clark in the States. And he's done a lot of work on the interaction between youth and young adults, and really how our society has been almost setting them up for failure. Now, I'm interested to sort of see again how you respond to some of his thinking, because if he's right, then we'll put it this way. One of the most challenging things, talks I've heard in the last 6 months, was actually by Chap Clark, where he was inaugurated as a professor at Fuller. And his talk, as he accepted that position, was called "And Don't Hinder Them." He took it from that phrase from Jesus which says, let the little children come and don't hinder them. And then he went to talk about all the ways the adult community have been hindering the spiritual formation of our youth and our young adults simply by the way we've started to structure our society. And it was like a smack in the face. So we'll look at some of the things that he's talking about there. And if all things are going well, I'll tell you a little bit about where I'm heading into the future with some study, and then got a spoken word piece from a performance poet called Joel McCarrow, who I think has just nailed the kind of experience that happens across this period of time. So that's some of the terrain that we can explore, and we cover one out of those four things. That's great. We've had a good chat.
Yeah. Right. Can everyone up back here, yeah, Rowan, okay?
Stand allowed. All right. So here's a piece that came out of America where they literally just stuck a camera in the face on an angle of a bunch of very Southern Americans and just asked them, was there a point where things went a bit wobbly for you, and tell me about
that God exists, then I just tell them where he came from. And I couldn't answer that question, and it doesn't say in the Bible, so I started doubting.
I've had doubts in my life about whether God is real or not. And some of the time when life was just really hard, and I just, you know, everyday struggles that you have, you just kind of wonder, you know, is God really there?
And my best friend, like, we were going through the same thing at the same time, where we really doubted God. I thought he was so, like, into the Word, one of the greatest Christians I knew, and then he started talking about, you know, what's this all for, and what's this mean, and is it real?
One of the things I really question is why there's so many different kinds of Christianity, and I wonder why every different person sort of has their own type of belief depending on what church they grew up in, and if you're wrong about that one side of Christianity, a lot of other sides of Christianity believe that they don't know.
It's always hard for me to understand what's eternity, meaning how can something last forever and ever and ever. I don't understand that all the time. And even though I believe it, even though God says so in the Bible, it's not always easy to comprehend that.
A couple of things that I really have, you know, trouble understanding and understanding the Trinity. I mean, I really don't understand how, you know, God can be three people all in one. I mean, I believe it because God says it's true, and I believe God does. But it's really confusing for many times, and it's really more than I can fathom.
What I doubt is even why God would want his children to suffer through life and bad things, such as their mother getting cancer or their father dying, or, you know, their parents getting divorced, something like that, that it's always hard to understand why God puts that in your big plan, or why God lets that happen to you or someone else.
I showed that to a group once and said, so respond, what did you hear in that? And he says, well, if you're Southern American, you're stuffed. I'm interested, do you want to react off that? Did you hear anything? Do you know anyone with similar questions? Yeah. One of you, yeah. Sorry, you didn't get off that.
I thought it was interesting how one guy said that one of his friends was like, probably Christianity, but he doubted how someone doubted his friend and they thought he was like, in faith, so
doubted. Yeah, yeah. Hang on. He was one of the reasons why I'm here, and now that's gone. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Others? Got it. I mean, I believe it, but,
yeah.
And now, what does I believe it? What's that code for?
I'm meant to believe it or something.
Yeah. You know? Sometimes I reckon, but I believe it is actually code for, I don't actually believe it. I don't. Like, I don't. It's kind of, I acknowledge that this is part of this thing called Christianity that I'm meant to be a part of.
Yeah.
So I acknowledge it, but what does it really mean to believe it? What does it actually mean to kind of try and fold that together? This is as we kind of interview lots of people who come into here, so we do start to get the story of where they're from. And when we ask them, well, why are you here? Why do you want to do, carve out a year out of your life and do this thing? The most common thing we hear is, I no longer know what it actually means to follow Jesus anymore, other than rocking up to church on Sunday and singing songs. The most common thing we hear. I don't really like them. 20, I could be doing this, 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 and this, and if I'm digging a trench as part of my plumbing apprenticeship, or if I'm helping nursing, or if I'm doing this, or doing that, I'm doing that, I cannot connect the guy in the sky with the things that I'm doing down here. It's just pulled, they're too far apart anymore. And sometimes I wonder if that's what faith is. Loosely speaking, it's actually connecting that. Because of the way this world is, because of God the Creator, in Him we live and breathe, and that kind of stuff. Therefore, I kind of know what I'm doing, and that comes through me out into this. When that whole thing is actually connected, that's when faith thing is happening. And so when I say I believe it, that's happening. No, I acknowledge that that's kind of it. Oh well, I'll keep digging, you know, and the disconnect grows. And what I tend to wonder with this young adult thing is the disconnect is actually happening, I reckon, around year 8 and 9, and the breaking point happens. Sometimes, depending on how okay things have been, the breaking point will then happen, sort of 18, 22, something like that, where they feel enough of their own identity to go, okay, 100 times I've said, I believe it, but I don't actually, and now I'm going to walk. Because they feel strong enough within themselves to go, you know, be friends beyond that. Still keep rocking up to church, but they've switched off. You can see it in their faces, you can see it in their eyes, everything that you say. They call it giraffe fart syndrome. Everything just goes straight over their head. You know, it's gone. see them. Right. Check out is they actually have the courage to leave. Right. And there's two key eras when this is happening. 13 and 14 is the key space, 12, 13, 14. And then 17, 18, 19, two hot spots of activity. And just as Esther introduced us to the fact that there's biology going on here at the same time as spirituality, let's not pull those two things too far apart, let's just think about that. 12, 13, 14, 17, 18, 19. What's happening in the adolescent and then young adult world in those two periods of time? We'll start with the first one. Starting high school, right? And biologically, what's happening? Puberty! Alright, well, that's confusing. Right. 17, 18, 19, what's happening? Yeah, leaving high school, graduating, moving from a world where their whole, you know, like 40 plus hours of their life is kind of guarded behaviour. Mm. You can stay here and fail, but if you actually disobey the rules, you're out. Alright, and then all of a sudden they leave that. And they're on their own, and no one's writing their timetable for them. And they get out of bed, it's because they have to self-generate that activity, alright? So the two greatest periods of faith checkout are correlated with the two periods of greatest social turmoil and biological transition, right? And, you know, this is where my studies are heading in the future, is we just, as youth ministers and as leaders and all that kind of stuff, we can't ignore it anymore, alright? Sociology and biology and spirituality, it's all tied together. It's all one big tangled mess. And you listen to the journeys of people who are rejecting their faith and walking away, and when you boil it down, it'll be, the moment I started to lose faith was when my friendship circle fell apart. The moment I started to walk away from faith was when my parents split up. The moment when, you know, like, when I started to grow hair on my chest, it all started to fall apart. You know, like, there's that kind of interweaving. It's a tangled, little, knotted up mess. And the most wonderful blessing you can be to young adults is to be with them and journeying with them. Because mostly they experience, but the younger they go particularly, that this faith thing just winds up as a tangled up knot, and they need lots of people around them to help them ask questions so that the tangled up mess can at least become an organised mess. And even if it's you disagree with their conclusions or whatever, the untangling process is just absolutely vital. Right? Because their tangled up mess they'll interpret as loss of faith.
Rowan, I often say one of the most important things I do as a tertiary chaplain is not giving people answers, but helping them ask the right questions. And I think that what you've just said shows the importance of that.
Yeah. Yes, and we'll look at questions soon.
This is the bridge.
Yes, right. A couple of also.
I think there's a second element to that. As you've been talking about the tank of events, dealing with that very individual on each young person. Mm. It's not a program that fits all. And that, I think, is most vital. Mm. What we have a habit of doing in church is that the programs may not really do much except gather them together. More
Yeah, that is so true. I would say that my guiding philosophy now for young adult ministry has to hover at no more than 3 at a time. Okay, that we've moved from, you can do programs at youth ministry. With young adult, you need to shift the model. It's much more like spiritual formation or spiritual directory or something like that, because now it's your questions. There's teaching and discipleship and so forth that happens through the teens, which is, what is this faith that we're socialising you into? But now you're individuating, you're starting to find your own specific place within this broader story. So what's your specific place within this broader story? And you're learning to do that one-on-one. Fabulous book, Hungry Souls, Holy Companions, by Patricia Hendricks, takes this spiritual direction paradigm and overlays it onto the mentoring relationship with young adults. Anyone else want to say something at this point? Just a couple of stories then just the words of the journey in young adults' words. I grew up in a church for literally my whole life. For years I was afraid of doubt or even asking questions, assuming it was a sin because it was implicitly taught to be so. There is not a Lutheran boy, okay, this boy. But the kind of gist that he got from the way church operated, where kind of the feeling was, if he had doubts, then there's something wrong. The biggest issue for me is that surely we can't expect people to arbitrarily and immediately believe in the dogma that they're taught, and surely they should be allowed and encouraged to ask questions. So it's really railing against this idea of, I didn't feel a space to doubt, and that's, I've got a bigger problem with that than the doubts that I've got, almost. Now, God and I are at peace with this. God is okay if I doubt him. As long as I keep genuinely seeking him, because as I now realise, he knows it's a journey and I don't have to fool him, and he's not angry. But to be too open about this with some of the religious people in my life would bring lots of flack because of their fear and insecurity, which sadly is right from the church circles in this part of the world. In the words of a 20-year-old. Okay? And you can agree and disagree with me. Sad, you know, this is how I perceive life. Yeah, right. Here's a question and another one. Another question I have is about the Bible being the authoritative word of God. It's a different person. I know I've quoted a whole lot of it, but I would be lying if I said that I've reached the perfect revelation that the Bible is true in its very nature. I have faith that this is the case, that there's that code. Yeah. Right. And I'm travelling towards the revelation of it, but I still can't say with absolute certainty if I believe the Bible is the Word of God. Find a company that other Christians have the guts to at least acknowledge that this question exists. And if you're like me, your gut reaction is to dive in and go, it is the Word of God, oh, it's awesome, let me hold it together, let me give you your, you know. Go, thank you, but my faith can't be in your faith.
Yeah.
Right? Your faith is part of my world and it's going to be important, but ultimately my faith cannot be in your faith. So I appreciate that and I'm encouraged by that, and that's why we do church and all the rest of it. But there's this other little piece of the puzzle which comes really, you have to do this every time. Okay. This is a great. Took a long time to think through this one. Why does God not reveal himself to someone who seems to be searching so hard? That's a good question. Why does God not, you know, people say, God, I want you, I want you, but it still seems a million miles away. Why is that? And her question really goes on to say, and some of the people have searched really hard and come to the conclusion, this God thing doesn't work. And I'm working on the same questions, and I'm teetering, wondering if they are. And so why should I trust for you over them? And again, the big shift that happens in young adults' life is there's a whole new set of authorities. So it's not just the parents, it's not just the pastors, it's also their peers, and it's also the media, and it's also and their peers who are becoming equal authority sources with the other sources of authority in their life. And they've tried, and they're going, no, it's not the case. Speedwalkers. How can a small, shy, broken, insignificant me do anything remotely useful here on earth? I can't be loved. Everyone else has demonstrated that I have to earn their love. My parents will love me if I do well academically. My sister will love me if I'm an unpaid taxi driver for her. My friends will love me if I spend time with them. How can God possibly love me unconditionally? This is interesting. The good news is too good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to walk away. I can't just believe what I just said. This is interesting. I know this is very extreme. As for being forgiven and redeemed, I have no trouble believing that others have been forgiven and redeemed, but at times I struggle to believe that same statement is true for myself. Surely by now I've crossed the line of how much sin God will actually forgive. I constantly find myself thinking that God made a mistake in putting me here. How can a small, shy, broken, insignificant me do anything remotely to be on earth? How can I make disciples of all nations when I can't even do that? Female age between 20 and 29. So you kind of see the shape and the distribution of how the age is sort of spread across the Australian public demographic. What do you notice about that? The baby boomers steaming through Victoria. Now, I did this, this is about 4 years old now, so we can change it around a bit again. But the baby boomers are steaming through. Alright? And if it wasn't for immigration, we wouldn't have population growth. Okay? Because, we used to have Costello when he was in government saying, alright, one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. We've got to keep growing here. Alright, but birth rates are really kind of dropped off. Okay. Alright, so that's bold here. Now here's the Australian church. Slightly different shape. Yeah, let's overlay. Where's the church? Where's the population? Okay. And you can see what's going on in here. Now, I was talking about this with a state-level youth coordinator of another denomination. And they said, but that just maps out the usual spiritual journey of a person where they go to church because they have to, and then in the teenage years they start to make some choices and they don't have to do what their parents say, so some of them start to fall away. And then when you're 20, you really don't have to do what your parents say, so you go off and sow your wild oats and break a few things. All the rest of it. But then those wild oats come back to haunt you, and you've got kids now when you're 30, and you start to feel a bit guilty that they probably should be going to church, and then what do you know, you're back by the time you're 40. And it's an interesting read on the stats, and this is from the National Church Life Survey. So the NCLS went and hunted it down, and they released a paper, which is just freely available via PDF, and you can look at it. And what they did is they went back to the 1960s and used a variety of sources to estimate the demographic profile. I mean, 1969, 70. And it basically went 1960, mirror image profiles of the Australian population and the Australian church. Which to some extent you sit there and go, well, it's kind of what you expect. Like, it's not like the Australian church is like Jenny Surf, which really only appeals to this age range, and probably not going to see 90-year-old women buying bikinis from Jenny Surf, unless it's a present for their 18-year-old daughter or something like that. But with the Australian church, they're not like that. Like, is there an age where necessarily Jesus means nothing? No, it's a whole of life kind of deal, so you can't expect. But since the 1960s, there has been a shift and a change in the way the demographic of the Australian church started to change and look different from the demographic of the Australian population. And it's been a constant story where progressively there's been this shifting in with this hourglass shape, starting from the teens, in the 20s, in the 30s, and then a broadening out towards the top. Okay? And that's just gone worse and worse and worse and worse for the last 4 decades. So that now, in the most recent, which is about to be redundant now, but sort of just the previous generation of the NCLS, when they released their kind of data in different bits and pieces, but their first cut is they first look at this kind of profile, and they said, the greatest challenge facing the Australian church is when to translate faith to the adult community. Because the future leaders are there and they're not. And they're going. And this data doesn't mean that they're coming back. This data means it's getting progressively worse, which means we're expecting there is some flow back, definitely. But the idea is that the bar that's at 30 to 39 10 years ago was at 20 to 29. So in 10 years' time, the bar at 20 to 29 is going to be in the 39-year-old slot, and who knows how to in the 2029, you're going to feel like that's called bracket creep. It's going to get travelled on its way through. And so while baby boomers are travelling through and really they kind of hold the power and the leadership of the church, there's going to be no one to replace them, is the kind of feel. And the general feel at the moment is it's never been like this before. Right? So the NCLS is usually fairly understated in their prophecy. Right. But when they came out and said the single greatest threat to the future of the Australian church based on these statistics is what they call the underrepresentation of youth and young adults in their church. They didn't use it, but another person did, and they said, we are hemorrhaging young adults. They're going and not coming back. Now you could think that maybe it's a style thing, and what we need to do is that Yeah, so Ghana's been looking this up, Ghana stuff a little bit later. Here's some other Australian stuff. It'd be easy to think, well, the problem is style. And if we just got a drum kit, everything would be okay. And so the UCLS...
You need to use it as well, Mark.
So the NCLS dived into this and wondered, what comes into, let me go this way, a little red pointer. That metal box, what they're measuring here, this is called the inflow-outflow analysis of the church. That metal box goes, this box, you're going to find a number of people which attend our church consistently over a 5-year period. Okay, so let's say there's 100 people in the church. If, for example, 80 people were there in January, and then 5 years later, you're still preaching to them, right? Then you've got 80 people in that box, which means 20 people arrived and 20 people left. Okay? So you can imagine, why do people arrive? Or they get born, or they move into state, and so they land in your area, and so they go to your church, or they got disgruntled with the pastor down the road or the church, whatever, and so they switched. Okay, so switching is that word. So top left, you can see switches in. And then another good reason for people to come to church? The gospel. We got converted. Yeah, newcomers. Alright, so the newcomer box, bottom left, they have people who have previously known Christian commitment now coming to your church. And interestingly now, they created a measure of what they call young adult retention as being the other factor. And so what's not there is, that's not the birth rate, right? That's not just the babies who are born. What they're measuring there, young adult retention is the percentage of people who are aged 15 to 19 who were there 5 years ago. Okay? So it's not just measuring babies, it's actually kind of a measure of people who are being brought up in the church and are still there after a 5-year period. Okay, so that's the inflow side. On the outflow side, you've got the opposite, people who switch out, so they get disgruntled and leave or move into state. And then this figure, drift out. And drift out is left this church and appeared at no other church or denomination 5 years later. Okay, so it's the best figure that we've got to measure faith loss, if you want to use that term. Okay? So at an Australian level, this is how it looks. If 100 people in your church, 80 people are constant. Okay, so it's a constant. If you're the preacher, you're rocking up, you're seeing their faces most weeks. Through a 5-year period, there'll be 80 of them. Okay? You'll get 8 newbies who've come from other reasons switching in. Alright? Now, 5% young adult retention, that's 5% of your total church have hung on for 5 years, 15 to 19. Okay? And 7% evangelism. Right? This is across the whole entire church. Alright? Switching out, 8%. So, obviously, that's going to be the same as switching in at the national level. We've got 8% of people dying. And then drift out is running at 10. Okay? So at that level, here's an interesting thing. We're able to do evangelism better than we're able to do ongoing discipleship. We've got 7% coming in out of evangelism, 10% just walking away out of faith loss. Right? Stripping away. Now, if we then just want to split this out a little bit, here's a difference. Right? So stability of community, much more stable, 88%. Now I've got to say, the stability of community is actually really good. Right? With the AAGs, for example, that's 64%.
Sure.
Right? Can you imagine being the pastor of a community where you had 40 new people and 40 people leaving out of 100 every 5 years? It's like Grand Central Station. You wouldn't need fans. The wind that you're feeling is the back door. It's people coming out, coming in. It's going to be really hard to pass that kind of environment. So having 88% is great. There's a lot more kind of stability and so forth. So you're going to expect a lot more less movement. So 3% in, 5% out, 6% young adult retention. That's above the Australian average. Well done. Right. Evangelism. Yes, Lutherans and evangelism. Grace thing, it just gets in the way. The death rate is just below the Australian average, that's not bad. 8%. Jews, that's pretty high. So there's a movement out that's quite profound in this. Alright, now that's 91 to 96. Now this is interesting, 96 to 2001, the stability's dropped a little bit, but the drift out has dropped significantly. Okay? And evangelism's gone up as well. And instead of going backwards at 11%, your overall shrinkage has dropped to 8%. So it's quite a positive movement. In fact, across the board, all churches have quite a positive movement. From the 96 to 2001 comparison to... that's probably changed. So the next one is 2001 to 2006. Oh, no, the other way around, sorry. So now, 91 to 96. Oh, I just did that the wrong way around, didn't I? Yeah, sorry, that's right. There you go. So that's obviously new. Yeah, okay. So... now, here's, we'll just do a compare and contrast. Here's Pentecostal churches, alright? 58% stability. That's that breeze that you're feeling, alright? In there. So, massive attractional church, the Pentecostal church. 28%, approaching a third, more than a quarter, a bit less than a third of people are just transferring in, alright? So they're leaving, so you know, they're switching out kind of thing, or they're all leaving town. Coming to a local Pentecostal church. But having said that, we've got exactly the same amount of retention as the Lutheran church. 5%. Unchanged. Right? Higher evangelism, 10%. They don't check out the drift out and the switch out. Right? Heaps of people in, lots of people out, and lots of people never coming back. And that was the old one, and the new one. No, they haven't repeated the analysis yet.
They've already done the 2011, should be.
Yeah, so this is like there's all their main data, and this is what I call a specialist in the code too. And I double checked it about 3 months ago, and I haven't seen the most recent. Has it been released, has it?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's coming out in 2011.
Because they do specialist projects alongside of their main NCLS stuff, so I don't know if they've chosen to continue this or not, but this is the most recent. Up until 4 years ago, it was only 91 to 96, and then in the last sort of 4 years, they did the 96 to 2009. And I don't know if there's just a massive lag that they need in the data to actually figure out if someone's still here or there or what's kind of going on. Anyway, I really just want to say at this point that the young adult retention is notched up by 1%. I just wanted to highlight that if we're just going to talk about the difference between, say, Lutherans and Pentecostals purely stylistically, alright, that there's a sort of obviously a much more contemporary flavour that tends to be Pentecostal than in AOG, there's no kind of stats that say, and they've solved the problem. Okay? The kinds of things that are happening in Pentecostalism is that young adult retention hasn't really significantly improved in any way, shape, or form. And they've got the reverse problem of a complete lack of stability. Working in and out and all over the place, and it's actually incredibly hard in terms of doing long term purity discipleship because they're here and everywhere. Okay? And I think that kind of points to the fact that there is enormous encouragement that comes for teenagers when you're part of a mess, when you're part of a large crew kind of thing. But when you're part of a large crew, you don't get the kind of individual attention that you actually need as a young adult. And so that whole thing starts to crumble a little bit. So in many ways, I love showing this to when I go to other, like particularly smaller churches, to say you've actually got an incredible advantage. If you don't have 1,000 young people, you're actually in a better position to actually have 1,000 young adults. And speaking, there was a big conference up in Queensland, the National Youth Ministry Conference, and that had a number of speakers that came in internationally, including Mike Kulachi from Soul Survivor. And it was fascinating to talk to him. I reckon about a third of the talks that I listened to and participated in there had some reflections about the young adult thing. And basically I've heard in all corners, in all places, and particularly that even like Mike Kulachi, who's just, you know, huge kind of movements and ministries, he basically says, I don't know what to do. This is what we're doing, but if you're going to push me and say you're an idiot, I'll probably say you might be right, because I don't know. There's such a crisis going on in young adults that it's thrown even the most confident, bombastic kind of ministers into saying, I don't don't know what to do about this, but I do know one thing, we're completely changing this ministry altogether. Right? And Mike's just gone on the record to say, as a result of the fact that we're doing all this stuff through youth ministry, and we thought, great, this is solving the problem, we'd expect to see really strong missionary zeal into their 20s, and they're just falling off the cart. We realised something really important. We got up there on stage and said, if you come and follow Jesus, your life, you'll be a global world changer. You know, he's going to revolutionise your life, blah, 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 blah. And then this person is 24, he's working a job that he hates, and he's sitting there, where would that world change you? And you go, really? Or we can just call it BS.
Yeah.
So they completely changed how they're doing youth ministry, because they realised that for maybe 10 years they've been over-promising and under-delivering in a few ways. Any thoughts or reflections?
That means there are praying really well to many people.
The question was, is the death rate low because their healings are really good? Statistically, I'd say, what does that tell you about the average age of a Pentecostal church?
I just find it interesting.
Am I?
Sorry. I find it interesting that you're presenting a quote at the start about how, you know, the youth interviewing say, I no longer know what it means to follow Jesus anymore, other than from like church on Sunday. For me, that got me ticking and thinking, you know, what is faith outside the church? And yet here, we're measuring it by church attendance. So it's in a way, I mean, I don't think it's in the underground or for maybe young adults, you know, being Christians in different and dynamic ways, but we're kind of, you know, presenting this as the only other option as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So these are presented in the sense that these are the numbers we've got. I've got some other numbers which I'll show you about. If you want to measure how young people are going in the context of church, there are some concerning stats out there.
Yes.
This is a great church. There's no blocking.
I think to me it shows that it's about relationships, and if it's okay to come to church if that's one day a week for them. If they don't build relationships with the right people, they're not going to be able to sustain that in their life.
Yep, absolutely.
Would you talk about our faith outside our church environment? Day-to-day interaction and how we cope with the challenges that come along. They're the sort of things that are tools that we need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's got to get really practical a little quick. I'm going to just move a little bit quick here because we've spent a lot of time here. Here's a couple of books that have come out recently just to quantify this more broadly than the church. Rethink by Steve Wright, Chris Grace came out of the Southern Baptist Movement. They've been rethinking how to do youth ministry. In their assessment, they reckon 58 to 84% of young people from Christian families leave the church as young adults. That's their survey of other surveys. Alright, but you're, you know, sort of between 2/3 and, well, it's a lot of, you know, whichever end of the spectrum you are, it's too many. Philosophy is the Barna Group, David Kinman. Conservatively, they would say 6 out of 10 were once involved, they failed to carry their faith into early adulthood. The Barna Group were interesting. They also then started to look at what were the reasons given for people leaving. Life experiences, such as gaining new knowledge or education, meant that Christianity just was not easy for people. Starting to feel disillusioned with the church and the religion and the kind of squabblings that are happening there. Hypocrisy in the church, negative church experiences, disagreement with Christianity about specific issues, and that point there. They've done subsequent research which has actually shifted that up to being the number one reason for young adults leaving is that they disagree with the public stance that the church takes on a variety of public issues. Yeah. The church being too authoritarian, that shifted to number two, and they elaborated on that to say that they felt that the church was intolerant of the questions of doubts and the space to do that. So,
which is exactly what you're saying before.
Yeah. The only place we could exercise our right to doubt was outside the context of our church. So,
yeah.
And in their minds, they're actually saying, this is the way I'm exercising my faith. But I can't do it here, ironically, I've got to do it out there. And so they wanted to express their faith outside the church, but they got discord. Now, oh, I can't tell you how many times I've been in trouble for this. Right? But when a young adult really kind of, if they manage to get through and navigate well and are at the other side, they get jazzed about all kinds of stuff. But usually it doesn't necessarily look like driving into ministry in their church or this and that. And they're doing Red Frogs. And they're involved in their campuses and doing all this kind of stuff. And if that young person happens to have gone through this, come out the other side and gone, I think I've actually got this Jesus thing together and I'm getting involved in the Sudanese community. The number of times I got knocked on the door by youth pastors saying, what'd you do to my youth leader? They were doing all right. And now they're off over there and now there's no one around my church anymore. I'm like,
preach
sorry.
Your brother.
Sorry. Talk about the kingdom. Yeah. Which is like, yeah, we said the church and then the world. Anyway. But yeah, like, it's, and, but I have to say, I also have great empathy for the fact that it's really hard to do ministry in the sense that, you know, you're employed to run a thing that has a certain number of people and they're all going everywhere. And if the broader church can bless a young, a youth minister or a young adult minister to get their people doing stuff all over the place, not just within their churches, then we're rocking. Right? But sometimes it's that internal accountability structure that's kind of tricky.
Rowan, I really, really resonate with what you're saying right now, and I have experienced that myself. That question of, well, why aren't there more now young adults sitting in our pews on a Sunday because of what we're doing? And right at the very start of my ministry, I said, this is not going to result in that. And people said, yeah, that's great, but 3 years down the track, when they're not actually there, it's not great. And yet, I stick by what I said before, that I see a generation of Christian young people who are faithful, who have issues of justice and evangelism and service right at the core of their response to the grace of God in Jesus. And that doesn't mean they're going to all be sitting in a church on a Sunday. Now, I'm not trying to disconnect the worship line, but it's a really important point that you're raising.
Yeah, post-modern thing is really... Like, now when I talk to churches, I'll actually say to them, so that, you know, I'm not employed by you, so I'm going to say this, and I don't know how to say it, but I think when you employ a youth ministry, an adult ministry, you need to think in a one-third model. One-third of their PD is ministry to the convinced. One-third of their PD, and convinced and here. One-third of their role is ministry to the unconvinced elsewhere, and one-third of their role is missions and evangelism, which means if you're thinking about the budgeting of this, only one-third of it is going to come from the convinced and here.
Can you have a talk to Greg Peach, please?
I'll say it for anyone. Joel.
My question is on the list you had just previous slide. I guess the question is, why did you leave, as opposed to, oh, you just broke up and left. But it doesn't seem that a list where a person just became secular or they chose the secular over the holy. Like, I could still believe the good thing about the church on all those things and just decide, well, the church doesn't fit my lifestyle and wanting to do what my friends do. Because if I lived in, an overly legislative, secular lifestyle,
sense that, in a sense, the questionnaire is set up to slightly kind of diss the church a little bit, in a sense, because it effectively saying, what was the straw that broke the camel's back? And so you kind of drifted, and then at some point you probably did exactly that and just wandered off into a different lifestyle. But at some, this question kind of asks you to go, now point the finger at something.
Yeah, you can react that hard. Journey
of people from 13 through to 28. Right? There's nothing like this existing. It's qualitative. So the research has gone back to about 1,000 people and actually had 1 hour interviews with them and then an hour with their parents. Okay? And then in and around that, they did phone surveys and internet surveys of another sort of 3,000 or 4,000 every time they did it. So they got more data than they know what to do with. Right? There's going to be research on this for the next little while. Here's one thing that they found. So they started to develop what they call a faith scale of maturity, measured by a variety of factors, including kind of their prayer life, experience of God, and so forth. It's a reasonably robust measure. And identify that in teenagers that they interviewed, they'd say 34% had a highly developed and mature approach to the faith and spirituality. It doesn't just have to be Christian, by the way, it's just all different. But it has a very strong Christian component in it. 30% moderately developed, 25% partially developed, 11% evenly developed. It kind of gives you a nice look at the correct students and the other issue of faith. Now, percentage of teenagers that move to a lower level in the next 6 years, so two rounds of surveying have gone through, out of that group, what happened over the next 6 years? In the highest bracket, half of them dropped. In the moderately developed, half of them dropped as well. In the partially developed, a third of them dropped. Okay. So, now while that means there's other people who are going in other directions, on average, and in the general gist of movements, and I'll show you a breakdown in a second, the overarching movement in terms of faith maturity, as you come through the teenage years and you go up, it gets a lot harder. And the general movement is that people start to fall away. Now, they developed this thing called religious trajectories, and it's got a statistical thing that I don't quite understand. It was like luster analyses of this and that and all that kind of stuff. But they developed what they call a religiosity scale. So this is sociologist, so it's a kind of a measure of faith maturity, if you like, by age. And they chucked all their data into it, did this kind of, told the computer to do something fun with it. And what it spat out was a clustering of an identification of about six different classic spiritual journeys. And so what they found was, in about 28% of people, they started at 15, relatively high mature in their faith, and headed there and stayed for about 30%. Right? And then there's this minority, 3.6%, a recognisable group, but not many, that started from a lower point and actually scaled up. Right? So that by the time they were 19, 20 years of age, they had a reasonably strong faith perspective. They found a whole bunch of people that just grey all the way through, right? And then no surprises, they also found the opposite. Okay, so that overall, low or declining was about 57%. We had a half and strong religious commitment at 36%. Now, what is really interesting about this, and what I'll highlight this, and I really wish you'd use this on quite different for 10 minutes, is that what... Do you want to have a break and come back to this, or are we going to analyze this?
Yeah, we're doing the panel after this.
Yeah, okay, cool.
You do get a chance to interact more with some of what Rowan's saying in the panel and
so
the forum.
Shut up, I've got 10 minutes, all right?
Yeah.
What he's highlighting is that if you encounter any 18-year-old, I guess the metaphor is it's really easy to think about youth ministry and young adult ministry like hungry hippos, which is to say that all these young adults are just kind of cruising around and they're waiting for the sermon or the Easter camp or the one conversation or the fireside thing to just go bam, that's it, everything's solved and we're off to Jesus now and away we go. But and Christian Smith is like he's got the metaphors behind it, made it so strong. He says they're all on a trajectory. They're not just hovering around waiting to go pow, suddenly be electrified, right? They're actually there going down, or they're going up, or they're staying, and there's lots of blips from time to time, right? But he says, like, the kind of metaphors I would use on this is because the statistics he found so penetrating and so strong in this was that the spiritual trajectory of a young person is kind of like an ocean liner, and if you're in ministry with them for a year, you're a tugboat, right? And if they've already got their keel kind of set in this direction and you're kind of tugging them this way, it's interesting, alright, but it's not hungry hippos. They're not just there, grab, and you got them, alright. They're actually going somewhere, and if you're going to change that trajectory, guess what you're going to have to do?
Stick around.
Be a little tugboat and stick around and be there for a while and you might. And he uses another minister, my hat's off to you, because it's a bit like being the guy at the Ford factory who just puts stickers on bumper bars. Like, if the rest of the factory line just made a mess of that car, fine, put a sticker on the bumper bar, but the whole car's a mess. You know? He says, I'm so convinced of this, he says, that the best thing you can do as a young adult minister is going to make sure the children ministry is going really well. Right? Because they're the one that's setting up the trajectory. They're like them as they come through. By the time you get to the end, they've got a whole lot of momentum behind them. Right? That's going one way or the other. And I don't want to be depressing, because there is good movement, but it has to shape how we do ministry. And being there, being around, and being a part of it becomes so important. So that's the check out stuff. I'm going to just move up here so I can jump ahead just something really quickly. Alright. I just want to change gears a second into that adolescent development, you know, that people hit puberty and then they lose faith kind of thing. So this is Chet Clark stuff. And remember, he was talking about how our culture has shaped adolescence. And this is how the theory goes. He says, adolescence and teenagerness and all that stuff that's a part of it, he says, we made it. It's not a stock standard period in life, in human life, if you look at all of human history. Our culture actually created adolescence. And this is how we did it. Right? He's gone on to the stats. He says, look, the start of adolescence is just puberty. That just throws you into a whole new way of being. And historically speaking, pre-1900s, the average age of an adolescent entering puberty was about 14, and then you can see it declining so that now we're about 11 or 12%. Whether that's, you know, bugs in the food or whatever, it's declining. At the same point, the kind of markers which tended to indicate moving into adulthood, which if you just traditionally say getting into a full-time job, starting to get married, settling down, that kind of stuff, pre-1900 it was 16 to 18, particularly in North America, in the industrial cultures, 18 to 19 by the 60s and 70s, and now mid to late 20s in the 2000s, which means that the length of adolescence in 100 years has gone from the 3 to 4 year period to the 10 to 15 to 20. But that period of in-betweenness, of finding yourself, figuring out your identity, wondering what you're going to do in life, or actually finally sitting down and structuring your life around classic kind of adult commitments of being a generative human being in society, is now pushed out over a 15 to 20 year period. And it hasn't always been that way. We're creating this thing that's called adolescence. And the biggest way that we're creating it is this thing that you identify as called social capital. And the story goes like this. If you can imagine, let's just pre-industrial life. So just, you know, imagine, if you will, you know, African nation or whatever, who still practice rites of passage. Right? But in a stereotypical kind of scenario, you had young people growing up, and if we just work with the boys scenario for a second, they start to show signs of wanting to take on adult kind of roles. What happens in that moment is that the elder in community gathers around them and marks them out as people who are now in transition. Now, we saw this when we went and were a part of the Maasai community for a very brief period of time. We're traveling through the Maasai community in Tanzania and Kenya, and they're like, it's just really weird because you go into this African area and they're all wearing this red kind of tartan blankets. It looks like kind of the Scots came in and dropped off all their blankets. They're bright red, big white smiles, but every now and then there was this teenager who was wearing black cotton, and his face was painted white. And it's just like, whoa, weird. That's the kids getting initiated. Right, so the whole community marks out the young people who are transitioning, and it's a stated process of about 3 years where they take boys and really have to put to death the child in order to raise the adult. And they do it in all sorts of ways, which really help the child move from, but are meant to help the child move from a role where they were reliant on the community to support them to where they move to becoming a protector and a provider. Which is why, you know, in classic stories, they're off killing lions or going out for 3 days with no food or water so they can survive, so they can change their role. So they're not receivers of the community, but they're givers and they're generative and so forth. But the main dynamic is the kids don't do this to themselves. It's not E9s, the Names of the Wild or Lord of the Flies or anything like that, the adult community says, hey, if you're going to become adults, we probably need a gathering of elders around you who've been there before to raise and pull you up into being an adult, right? Because as a child, you never kind of get to a stage where you go, I'm now an adult. You can really only do that once an adult says to you, you are. I've seen that quality in you and I want to name that as a man or as a woman or so forth. It's passed on. It's bequeathed to you. Don't just grab it as a young person, right? And so it's adults gathering around teenagers that drag them through adolescence and immerse them into adult life. And if you sit there and think about it, it's not rocket science, right? Kids journeying together don't become adults. Adults passing on adulthood to kids made adults, right? People that have been there before do this kind of stuff, right? But what we've done is we've changed that. So industrialization comes through, and the parents go off to factories, and kids sit in mass, in school, in age-stratified groups. And what happens? Kids are becoming detached from the eldering community, and if you think about it, your average year niner gets how many minutes of one-on-one time with their parents? Less than 20, usually, a day, less than an hour, often, within a week. How many one-on-one times would your average year 9 boy or girl get with an adult who has nothing better to do than be interested and consumed in their life? Almost zero. Alright? How many professionals are around them? Teachers, coaches, piano teachers, lots. Alright? But not people who are just interested and concerned because they are. Right? They've all gone. And so that whole role of a community, getting elders around the young people, being interested, concerned, and helping them move from, alright, we've kind of shifted it out and outsourced it. We've kind of professionalised it in ways that, in a sense, have actually extended out. Because the kinds of questions that help a young person move into adulthood, I'm sorry to the teachers in the room, but oftentimes they don't trust the teachers with the question. Right? And in our churches where they have the big faith questions, I feel like the churches can't tolerate the questions that they have. Right? And so your average, and you know when you're sort of doing a confirmation program and you go to confirmants and you say, hey, we need you to find a mentor. And the first thing that goes through their mind is, who the heck would be interested enough to be my mentor? Who am I connected enough to? I can't even think of any. Right? At the time when they most need the adults gathering around, they're feeling the most, and Chuck Clark uses this term, systemically abandoned. There was two studies in the United States which looked at why the risk factors in the parenting community were going off the charts, and then 3 years later they looked at why the risk factors in the adolescent community were going off the charts. In the parenting community, they found that the way Western society structured life put an inordinate amount of pressure on the home unit just to economically survive and make it. And they figured out that that was resulting in parents not getting enough space to devote emotional energy to their own care. Yeah. And so they were engaging in risk behaviours. Then they looked at why there's risk behaviours going on in adolescence. And they concluded that all our adolescents are going AWOL because the parents and the adults aren't just routinely around them anymore. They're basically alone and left to themselves because everybody's off working. And it took them another 3 years to go, hang on a second. We've created a society where the adults are so pressured they don't have enough emotional reserve for self-care, which means they don't have enough emotional reserve for childcare and adolescent care, which means they're all being left to themselves. And what do you know? We've got risk factors going off the roof. Now the word for this is called social capital. And a great big challenge, and why let the little children come and do not interfere with that, how we interfere with the development of our young people and our young adults, is that they're becoming increasingly systemically abandoned by the system. And you can see the difference between these two pictures, and I'll just for the sake of time, the kids got help and a safety net, right? The kids got a bit of a safety net, but now they're a little bit different, and now the kids are on their own. Chuck Clark talks about the fact that the two poles of adolescence, of childhood and adulthood, have been moved apart by the industrial age. Right? People aren't becoming adults now for 15 or 20 years, and you can only do this journey by yourself. You have to do this journey as an individual who starts to find their place within this kind of space, I think the only way you can do that is with adult support, social capital, and it's all gone. It's all gone. So we created adolescence by reducing our social capital and leaving them all alone. And so now the research is coming out, this is Search Institute, sorry about the text, but it says study after study in the field of youth has found that the single most important thing that can make a positive difference in the life of a young person is the presence of interested and concerned adults. Full stop. And this is Dr. Peter Benson, who's like, if there's something about adolescence he doesn't know, it hasn't been found out yet. 15 years, 30,000 kids, the whole bit, right? And he says, we've searched it all, we've got the 40 assets, we've got everything. You want to ask what's the most important thing? If you can put an adolescent with just 5 adults who are just a little bit interested and concerned, about 95% likely to be okay. For every one less, and this is Sticky Face, which is the Fuller Institute stuff, they found if you have 5 adults around a young person and these 5 are active in their faith, and this person is well attached, relationally attached to the adults, that person will be fine in their faith. And for every one less adult, there is a statistically measurable increment down in the likelihood of their faith maturity. And the same is true that if a person's alone, for every additional adult, they're finding a statistically significant incremental gain in the maturity of faith of the young person. Every single adult, there is a shift, there is a change. So I want to, I guess we'll leave here at this point, so I've not gone on long enough, but there are significant challenges facing the young adult community, and a big part of where I'm at with this is that we're leaving them to themselves, to the young. We're programatizing their format into these large mass things. We're becoming too segregated as churches, where we have youth ministries and things like this. Churches we're building up aside for youth ministry. We create entire ministries that are called young adult ministries, sometimes entire congregations, because the rest of the church just doesn't know what to do with them. And this is where talking to Mike Pilavarci, he goes, look, there's a situation where, in some sense, when we make a microcosm of young adults, in a sense you might say we're perpetuating the problem, but he goes, I don't know what else to do, because all the church can't handle them. They don't know what else to do, so we're just going to have to do this with them. And so we've got segregated youth ministries that now have to move on to segregated young adult ministries, and unless we can actually start from scratch and go kids and adults and we're all in this together and get the intergenerational connections all the way through, and then change what that looks like. So it's teaching in primary school, it's teaching and questioning in teenagers, and then a spiritual formation through the young adult period, and change that format all the way through. It's going to change. Sorry for that.
Can I just highlight the aspect more?